We've come to one of the final turns here in Matthew's gospel. And you can see this because Jesus is teaching in the temple and he is finding himself negotiating traps that are being set for him. In this case, we have the chief priests and the elders coming to him with a fascinating question to serve as a trap. On what authority do you do these things? And who gave you this authority? And by these things, I think they mean this teaching, this healing, these events that they cannot explain in any other way. And Jesus knows a hot potato when he sees one or feels one. And so he does what he often does when he gets these questions, which is to send them on back. And so this is what Jesus does. He says to the religious authorities who have given him this trap, he says, well, by whose authority do you think John the Baptist was acting? And he does this because he recognizes what the trap that they have set for him is. Because if he says that he's acting on divine authority, that could well lead to the road to blasphemy. But if he says that he's only acting on human authority, then he has no ground to teach upon. So he does this. He sends it back to them, and he knows full well that the chief priests and the elders are caught in a trap of their own, which has the Roman Empire here and the people here. Because the people regarded John as a prophet, so it could not be of human origin, which leaves divine origin for the grounding of authority. And so what are they left with? Well, they take what they hope is the option of least resistance, which is to say, we don't know. And I kind of think at this point they are hoping to just quietly turn around and walk away, nothing to see here. Except that Jesus is not done. This teaching is not over. And so he calls them back, and this is what you just are always afraid of in class, when the professor turns to you and says, well, what do you think? Because Jesus says, what do you think? And he tells a story, a parable of sorts. We're back in the vineyard. There's a man who has a vineyard, and work needs to be done, as is the case in vineyards. And so he tells one of his sons, go and work in the vineyard today. The son says, no. But later reconsiders and goes to work in the vineyard. The father then says to another son, go and work in the vineyard today. And this son responds, yes, but does not go. Now, which of the sons does the will of his father? It points to an obvious answer, doesn't it? And this is why I'm not quite sure if it's a parable. I mean, it's thrown alongside, but there's not that subversion as part of it that we usually see. Because the answer, of course, is the son who does the work. And this isn't enough for Jesus, right? Because not only has he spun the trap back and he sprung it, but he adds this twist. And the twist is, so those tax collectors and those prostitutes, the ones that you presume to be outside of the family. Well, actually, even though at first they denied God's authority through the commandments and the relatedness, they have listened and they have turned and they have come back to the vineyard and acted. And then it gets even more pointed because, of course, who are the ones then that have said, yes, I will go work, and then haven't? It's the religious authorities, those chief priests and the elders, the very ones who questioned the ground of authority that Jesus stands on. I'd like to spend a little bit of time with authority as a word and as a notion, because it doesn't seem to be entirely popular right now at this time, and particularly in this place. And I have some sense as to why, because throughout the decades, particularly in this past century, authority has been misused and abused to disastrous and destructive ends. But at its root, the meaning of the word authority comes from that first part of it, from author. An author, of course, is to create, to generate. So at its essence, authority means the power to create. The power to create. And this is something that we don't often understand about it. We see it through very different lenses. But with Jesus, this authority, this power to create, comes from healing, comes from questions, from challenges, from presence, from trust. This is how Jesus uses his authority to create. But we often struggle with this because we sometimes find it hard to remember that authority is bi-directional. That is, it fundamentally operates as a two-way street. But so often we conceive of authority as one-directional, as in just going this way and often downhill, backed by force. But any parent of a toddler knows differently. Right, when you have a two-year-old, for instance, one of the first words that human beings seem to learn, and for sure one of the first words of power that human beings learn is what?
No!
No! We learn it at a very early age, and any parent who has experienced this knows firsthand that authority is a two-way street. You can give a command or make a request of me, but unless I actually engage it, unless I participate in it, it goes nowhere. And so this week I have been thinking about one of the great saints of the church whose feast day we've been celebrating today. It is Francis of Assisi, Francesco. His feast day in the West is October 4th on Wednesday, but we've brought it to today so we can celebrate it in fullness. And most often when we think of Francis, we think of animals and his love of animals and his songs to the creation, which is good. And there are other parts to Francis's story that I think we need to remember. One of them took place at the beginning of his life in his religious community. And it's when, it's now about the year 1210. Now, at this point in his life, there were a group of people who were so compelled by his witness that they began to follow him. And what you need to know about the 13th century is that it was splintered with heresies. The Roman Catholic Church was doing its best to find out how to respond. And so when you get a group of people, say a fanatical band of people who live by austere poverty, who gather together in solidarity with the poor, and who want to rebuild the church, it can make people nervous. And so the bishop of this area said to Francis, you know, you really should go and seek the dispensation of the Pope. It's probably in everybody's best interest. And so through some connections, Francis and the companions come to Rome, and they are granted an audience with Pope Innocent III. Now, Pope Innocent III was, without a doubt, a great spiritual leader of the Roman Catholic Church, and this being the Middle Ages and the Roman Catholic Church, he was also likely the most potent temporal leader in the world. And so Francis and his companions enter in to seek this audience. And if you have seen the film Brother, Son, Sister Moon by Zeffirelli, you might have this in mind. I want you to imagine Francis in rough cloth, without any shoes, pretty dirty, entering in with six companions into this great, enormous space that is filled with mosaics, stories high, and gilt everywhere. And they walk through this gauntlet of archbishops and cardinals as they are ushered forth. And they ask this request of Pope Innocent III, and they are denied. Now, depending on how this tale is told, when this denial happens, Pope Innocent III has a dream. And in this dream, he sees St. John the Lateran, the basilica, crumbling. But he sees it being repaired and held up by a small, simple man. And so, a second time, Francis and his companions come to see the Pope. And they come up the hall again. They come up into the space down on the floor. And this time, Francis makes his plea. And he uses the words from the Sermon on the Mount. But this time, there's an awakening in Pope Innocent III. Whether it is something he has seen or heard, something has changed. And despite the whisperings of his advisors, the elderly Pope rises from his throne and begins to walk down the steps past all of the stunned cardinals and makes his way all the way to where Francis and his companions are. And he actually kneels down onto the ground and kisses Francis's feet. Now, I don't know exactly what happened for Pope Innocent III to act this way, but I wonder if the most powerful person in the world recognized an authority that he did not have, that was true, and that called him back into the vineyard. Why do we say yes and then go do otherwise? Is it because it's going to be hard and we avoid things often that are hard? Is it because we didn't have the courage to say no? Why do we say no and then do otherwise? Is it because we felt the guilt rising? Or because there is a truth that has continued to emerge? The righteous life does not come by fiat. If that were the case, there would be no free will. There would be no real relationship. We wouldn't need to be here right now. If God wants our will, it's so that God can give it back. The righteous life is offered in invitation. It is something that we receive, and God is inviting us to act upon it. Not out of burden or obligation or duty, but out of love. And it's a kind of authority that requires willful participation. Friends, we have said yes to working in the vineyard many times, and we've meant it. And we often have not lived it. The good news is that there is always time to turn back, return to the vineyard, and act. And I hear that the owner of the vineyard is hiring all day